My next guest is Rich Powers, head of ETF and index product management at Vanguard, who currently offers 82 ETFs, over $2 trillion invested here in the U.S. Rich is now on the line with me from Pennsylvania. Rich, always enjoy connecting. Thanks for taking the time.
Dave, thanks for having me back.
All right, so let me start by offering a few stats from Vanguard's 2021. These are pretty remarkable. Over $325 billion in ETF inflows. That shattered the previous annual mark for a single ETF issuer, which was somewhere around $200 billion. Vanguard had six of the top 10 most popular ETFs last year, including the top two. You also had one of the top ETF launches last year with a Vanguard Ultra Short Bond ETF, ticker VUSB. And then, as I mentioned, Vanguard's U.S. ETF assets are now over $2 trillion, which I have to tell you, Rich, that's equal to total industry assets at the end of 2014, just for a nice stat for you. But talk a little bit about the year Vanguard had last year.
Nate, when you kind of rattle off all those stats, it's quite humbling. And as you know, our objective isn't cash flows, right? It's to serve investors really well, but certainly cash flows are a really good measuring stick as to how we're doing that. And, I think you can point to a couple things that would explain why we've enjoyed success in the last year, or last few years, and it's our low-cost offer. I mean, that's always been part of who we are, but we have leadership in expense ratio and total cost of ownership across the majority of our ETF lineup. Our funds track really well, so investors know they're going to buy a total market index fund. They're going to get the return of the total market. And I think the Vanguard brand is a powerful one, right? People know that what we stand for and that we're a mutual organization there where our interests are aligned with theirs, and we try to return value to them in a variety of forms. So I think there's no confusion there. Maybe two other stats, Nate, that I'm really proud of in terms of what we were able to accomplish. We've got 82 ETFs. 77 of them enjoyed positive flows in 2021. So that tells me something that the wide array of products we offer meet a wide array of investor preferences, and we're doing well there. And then the last stat I'll just share is 46 of the 82 ETFs in our lineup received $1 billion or more in cash flow. So not only are we widely resonating across our lineup, but in a meaningful way for large clients who are allocating on behalf of individual investors.
When you mention those 77 ETFs with positive inflows, one area in particular I'm curious about is your bond ETF lineup. So obviously stocks had a tremendous year last year, right? The S&P 500 was up 28% or so. So it makes sense that stock ETFs would have a great year. But I was looking, Vanguard also had five of the top 10 most popular bond ETFs in terms of inflows last year. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the top new ETFs of 2021, the VUSB, the Vanguard Ultra Short Bond ETF. Did that surprise you at all, just the continued interest in bond ETFs given the interest rate environment and the talk around inflation? And I guess talk more about Vanguard's commitment to the bond ETF space.
Yeah, one of the most gratifying things that we've seen in terms of investor behavior and cash flows is that they're finding their way to really broadly diversified core asset allocation ETFs, be it a total bond market fund or total international bond on the fixed income side. On equity, we've talked about total stock and our S&P 500 in the past. So I think that's really important. I think what this the success of fixed income ETFs in the industry at large tells you is that we are still in the very early stages of fixed income ETF adoption. I think 2020 was the record year for fixed income ETF cash flows. Last year nearly matched it. And that's kind of mind-blowing when you think about the rate environment we're in, where bonds aren't offering much in the way of yield. And I think when you kind of try to connect the dots here, what that tells you is that investors look at fixed income ETFs as an incredible tool in their toolkit that maybe hasn't gotten as much use in the past, but will in the future. And then when it comes to our aspirations and our activities in fixed income, we're really optimistic and bullish on fixed income ETF adoption into the future. We continue to build out our lineup there. If you just look at the last five or six ETFs that we've launched, half of them have been fixed income ETFs. As we've had gaps in our lineup, and if I'm looking at our research portfolio in the years ahead as to what areas we're going to explore to build our lineup out, fixed income certainly has a large place in that research portfolio.
Going back to Vanguard's ETF flows overall last year, that $325 billion plus, Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas had an interesting stat that while ETFs currently account for about 24% of Vanguard's assets, they were 92% of your net flows in 2021. And he also said that only about $13 billion was investors moving from the mutual fund share classes to the ETF share classes. Is there anything to take away here? I mean, clearly this is good for your ETF lineup, but does that cause you any concern on the mutual fund side?
I think what that stat kind of speaks to is this significant move and adoption by individual investors and advisors who want to index client portfolio assets or their own assets, that the ETF is the preferred structure there for any number of reasons, right? Is it the flexibility in terms of when you know, put money into the market, given the time of day? Is it the cost side? Is it the ability to avoid commissions or ticket charges? Certainly ETFs have advantages there.
Rich, before we move on, just looking more broadly, ETFs took in over $900 billion last year. So that obliterated 2020's record of over $500 billion. We, of course, had a record number of launches. You look at total U.S. ETF industry assets, now over $7 trillion. We don't need to spend a lot of time here, but did anything in particular stand out to you last year as you looked at the industry overall?
Yeah, I think as much as we talked about, as much as the conversation was about some of the shinier object products that were either launched or were getting some interest, what you saw is by and large investors using the low-cost, broadly diversified portfolios in a significant way. So, we were thrilled to see that happening from a marketplace adoption standpoint. I think the other kind of interesting thing that happened was pretty significant adoption of international equity ETFs in the year. Right? I think international equity has been somewhat unloved in terms of how investors asset allocate and the performance, partly I think attributable to performance. But you saw a meaningful uptick in international equity allocations in 2021. Certainly aligns with our forecast around international markets having a brighter potential return future, given where valuations are in the U.S. versus international. And so I think those are kind of the two things. The adoption of broad market funds continues despite the narrative out in the marketplace and the move into international equity.
All right. With our remaining time, I have a few fun topics for you. These might be more fun for me than you. We'll see. But I do know this first one is right up your alley, which is ETF fees. You were talking about Vanguard's leadership and expense ratio. It's certainly tough not to talk fees when discussing Vanguard. So I checked yesterday. You know I love my stats. The average Vanguard ETF expense ratio is 9 basis points. And the weighted average expense ratio is, this is hard to believe, less than 6 basis points. But even with those numbers, Vanguard is still out here chopping fees. I mean, just in December, you reported fee reductions in 9 fixed income ETFs. I also saw these comments recently from your CEO, Tim Buckley, where he said Vanguard would cut $1 billion from its fund fees by 2025. That's after cutting $140 million in fees last year. Just talk a little bit about Vanguard's fee philosophy. It's amazing.
I think what Tim's comments allude to is that we're simply built differently than every other asset management firm in the industry. You know, the Vanguard Group is owned by the funds and ETFs in our lineup, which by virtue of that are owned by the individuals and advisors and institutions who own the funds. And so that differentiates us in the marketplace because all of our competitors are either publicly traded or privately owned. And so they're built to generate profits for those owners, be it the private or public owners. Whereas for us, we're built to generate profits on behalf of our shareholders. And we're able to return those profits to shareholders in the form of better services, right? Enhancing our website, offering additional services, or by lowering fees. And what we're doing now is just a continuation of what we've always done. And what really sets Vanguard apart, which is you can count on us to continue to find ways to return value to shareholders in the form of lower costs, be it in target date funds, be it in ETFs.
So obviously those low fees from Vanguard, and certainly there are other issuers out there as well that have very low cost index-based ETFs and mutual funds. I want to ask you about this interesting article from MarketWatch last week, titled "The SEC's Next Regulatory Target Could Be Index Providers." This created a little buzz, and there was a lot here, but one of the areas covered was the potential systemic risks created by indexing, which I know you and I have covered this in the past, but Rich, this topic just won't go away. And when you think about the massive inflows we've been discussing here today, there's this narrative that money is just blindly flowing into the S&P 500 and other broad indices, and nobody's paying attention to the underlying company fundamentals. Now, obviously, I know where you stand on this overall, but for people who are concerned out there, which they are out there, how would you respond to that line of thinking?
Yeah, I think the first place to start is indexing. The rise of indexing has been unequivocally great for investors, right? That means they've achieved better outcomes from a return standpoint. They have more money in their pockets rather than in the pockets of the asset managers. And so for those reasons, indexing has been great. I think the stat that I recently saw was something like half of all pooled fund assets are in an index strategy. And as we know, like index strategies come in very many different forms, but let's just call it half of the assets are in indexing, which is an incredible stat. And it's not surprising that some will glom onto that and say, wow, that should be concerning. But when you start to kind of drill down and dig into the layers a little bit, it becomes a little more clear why the rise of indexing is not problematic in terms of market structure. So about 15% of all investable assets in the market are held in some type of indexing strategy. So I talked before about pooled funds. 15% of the market is in indexing when you throw in hedge funds, individual investors, insurance accounts. So 15% is not that large of a number. It gets even smaller when you think about the amount of trading that you can tie directly to an index strategy. About 5% of all trading happens in the market driven by some type of indexing strategy. So if there's this notion of indexing is somehow disproportionately impacting price discovery or valuations, it's really hard to make that connection given the fact that 95% of the trading that happens, which leads to price discovery and valuations, comes from something other than indexing. And then maybe, Nate, the last point I'll offer to you, there's still more work to do here. I think there's more room for indexing to grow. There's something like $6.5 trillion globally that's invested in products that charge 1% or more. My guess here is that many of those clients are not getting the outcomes that they had hoped for. And so we think there's more room for us to bring indexing to more and more investors.
Is there a point at which there is too much indexing out there? Is there a natural cap to how much of the market can be indexed before it does become a problem in your eyes?
Gosh, I'm not sure what that number looks like, but if we use the starting point, and I think the most relevant data point that I shared earlier around what you would look at is how much of the market activity is driven by indexing. Something materially bigger than 5% would probably be where a conversation needs to start. But you know, we've been at that 5% number for a number of years, which simply tells you that a lot of money is still in the hands of investors who take something other than a passive approach.
All right, just a couple minutes left. I'm going to tee you up with one last fun topic. So you may or may not know this, but one of my 2022 ETF predictions is that the Vanguard share class patent will become a hot topic of conversation. So I could be wrong here, Rich. As I understand it, that patent expires in 2023. Now, I know that you're not on the legal side of things. You're not a Vanguard attorney. But are you able to speak at all to what happens next year? Like, can anyone pursue this structure once the patent is up? Is this something that's on your radar? Is there more to all this than what I'm stating here?
Yeah, Nate, your facts are correct. Our patent expires in 2023. And so at that point, any other asset management firms could pursue a multi-share class ETF offering. They can pursue it, but they'll be pursuing it with the SEC through the exemptive relief process, right? So take you back a couple of years, the SEC went through a pretty arduous effort with the industry to create a little bit more clarity and straight-through processing with respect to how products are launched and brought to marketplace. And they created what's called the ETF rule, which effectively says, here's an easy pathway for you to bring products to market versus historically what they've done, which is every product that ever came to market got individualized exemptive relief. That could be painful, many years in the making. And so other firms who now will have access to considering launching multi-share class ETFs will not be able to use that easy pass. They'll need to go through the exemptive relief process and engage with the SEC. In the end, no impact to Vanguard. The benefits we've got from launching multi-share class ETFs, call it 70 of our products, accrue early on in those products' life cycle, where we're able to launch them with diversified portfolios, low cost tracking really early on. But over time, those benefits diminish and kind of equalize over time. And so, it'll be interesting to see what other firms kind of consider this, but it's not a slam dunk that, in terms of how they have to go through the regulatory process to bring any products they might want to market.
No, I appreciate the comments there. I think it would be much more interesting if we see other companies try to pursue the Vanguard mutual ownership structure rather than the share class structure. That could be interesting from a competitive dynamic standpoint. Not sure we're ever going to see that. But Rich, always appreciate the time. Fantastic perspective. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks so much, Nate.
That was Rich Powers, head of ETF and index product management at Vanguard.